Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Teresa Younger of the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union, who examines the Bush administration's decision to hold a U.S. citizen suspected of plotting a terrorist bombing as a military prisoner, without court review and with no access to an attorney. Alicia Littletree of the Redwood Summer Justice Project, who describes the landmark court victory against the Oakland Police Department and FBI in the case of two environmental activists falsely accused by these police agencies of engaging in terrorist activities, and Scott Klinger with the group Responsible Wealth, who discusses how a progressive coalition recently beat back attempts to permanently repeal the federal estate tax in the U.S. Senate. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that the Bush administration is using its war on terrorism to stamp out independent views among officials with the United Nations and other international organizations. The first victim of the Bush purge was Mary Robinson, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and former President of Ireland. This spring, U.S. officials lobbied against her reappointment because of American complaints that Robinson was difficult to work with. More specifically, the White House was upset with Robinson's handling of the UN Conference Against Racism last summer in Durban, South Africa, where the U.S. and Israel walked out in protest. The next victim was Robert Watson, the respected chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In mid-April, Watson was replaced by Indian economist Rajendra Pajori. That came just 2 months after ExxonMobil asked the Bush administration to replace Watson and to fire Clinton Gore holdovers who attend IPCC meetings. José Mauricio Bustani, who ran the five-year-old Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, was the next target. Bustani had crossed John Bolton, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control. Bolton had objected to surprise inspections by the U.N. agency at U.S. bases and was upset that Bustani was pressing Iraq to sign the International Chemical Weapons Convention. Others in the crossfire include Hans Blix, head of the team of weapons inspectors in Iraq, and Peter Hansen, head of UNRWA, the agency that aids Palestinian refugees. Hansen actively defended the UN team set to inspect the Jenin refugee camp after much of it was destroyed this spring by Israeli forces. After facing cries that it blew the anthrax investigation, the FBI is now exploring the theory that the anthrax spores used in bioterror attacks last fall were developed at a U.S. Army biotech lab, smuggled out, and then sent to its intended victims through the U.S. mail. According to the Hartford Courant, the FBI has questioned several microbiologists about access to anthrax inside the Army's medical research lab at Fort Detrick, Maryland. The FBI is following the theory that the anthrax attacks were an inside job by U.S. government scientists. The theory was first floated last winter by Barbara Hatch Rosenberg, the top bioterror expert at the Federation of American Scientists. She has posted on the FAS website a profile of the scientist she believes orchestrated the anthrax attacks. According to Rosenberg, this scientist had a career setback last summer that left him angry and depressed. The FBI recently searched this unnamed scientist's home and computer. Rosenberg says the FBI sat on this information for months and possibly lost valuable evidence. An investigation in 1992 found that the Fort Detrick lab mislabeled specimens of anthrax spores, Ebola virus, and other pathogens. Clearly, there is a history of lax security at U.S. biotech labs, and there was plenty of opportunity for a trained scientist to grow deadly spores and disperse them around the U.S. In a landmark human rights decision, California State Judge Victoria Cheney ruled that Unocal, a Los Angeles-based oil giant, must stand trial for condoning the use of forced labor on its massive Burmese gas pipeline project. This is a major victory for the Burmese citizens who first filed suit against Unocal in 1996. The case alleges that villagers were forced to work on the pipeline's infrastructure by Unocal's project partner, the repressive Burmese military that has ruled the Asian country for over a decade. The military were also in charge of security for the pipeline project. In her June 10th ruling, Judge Cheney stated that Unocal was liable for the human rights abuses committed by the Burmese military, abuses that Unocal was completely aware of. The ruling, if upheld on appeal, could set a precedent in other human rights cases, holding American corporations accountable for their actions overseas. In mid-May, 34% of Unocal shareholders voted for a resolution calling for the oil giant to adopt a code of conduct based on the rules of the International Labor Organization, which bans forced labor. The case, Doe versus Unocal, claims that since 1992, when Unocal signed a deal with Burma's ruling military regime, the army has engaged in a systematic campaign of human rights and environmental abuse, including extrajudicial killings, torture, rape, and extortions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Attorney General John Ashcroft announced last week that Abdullah al-Muhajir, an American citizen, also known as Jose Padilla, was detained by federal agents in early May, accused of participating in an al-Qaeda plot to explode a radioactive bomb in the U.S. For over a month, the former gang member from Chicago has been locked up in a military prison without being formally charged and denied the right to consult with an attorney. Since the September 11th terrorist attacks against New York City and Washington, the Bush administration has systematically denied due process to thousands of detained immigrants, and now it appears U.S. citizens. The White House defends its actions by citing World War II-era Supreme Court decisions upholding the government's right to treat those it accuses of working for foreign powers as enemy combatants. But civil liberties advocates warn that the erosion of constitutionally mandated checks and balances on government power will have far-reaching consequences for our democracy and America's standing in the world community. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Teresa Younger, executive director of the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union, who examines the Bush administration's assigning onto itself unilateral powers to determine the guilt or innocence of suspected terrorists without judicial review.
What the Bush administration keeps saying is that they respect the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and that everything, that all of their actions will stay within the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And what they've done here is the president himself has completely taken the rights of this gentleman away by declaring him an enemy combatant. And the president is now the person that can determine which Americans will have constitutional rights and which Americans will not. And that's a very, very scary spot for us to be in. And unfortunately, the Bush administration, since September 11th, insisting that they're making us safer, have not necessarily been making us safer. They've just been taking away a considerable amount of our rights. There is nothing wrong with the American judicial system, technically. We know that in times of crisis, when we have had other terrorist attacks, the American court system has worked. And so we need to go back to that. The government has yet to tell us why it wouldn't work for us to try this gentleman in the American courts. And I think that's a very important thing we need to consider. The American courts have worked, and they worked during the 1993 World Trade Center bombers. They worked when we went through the case of the Oklahoma bomber, Timothy McVeigh. They have worked, and we need to allow them to work. And what's interesting right here is that although Mr. Padilla has not been charged with anything, non-citizens like Zacharias Moussaoui are being tried in the American courts, and here we have an American that's not even being tried in the American courts and being denied complete due process. We don't know if he's spoken to a lawyer. We don't know what his charges are. Those are very serious concerns, because if you can do this to one American citizen, you can do it to a multitude of American citizens.
Teresa Younger, how do you respond to the what we hear very often from the White House, is that this is a time of war and extreme measures must be taken to protect the nation? How do you respond?
Yeah, well, you know, this may be a time of crisis, and some would determine that this is a time of war. Others would not. Congressional leadership hasn't declared it a time of war. But regardless of all of that, we cannot just throw out all of our rights and say, here, government, we're not going to hold you accountable. You can just do whatever, because we won't get them back, and they will start infringing on the everyday citizens' rights when they get too close. So we just need to be very, very aware, people need to inform themselves, and they need to take responsibility for speaking up and questioning the government. Is what they are doing making us a safer, more effective, more upstanding, worldly citizen, or are we undermining the very principles by which we have built America? We have to look back at our very own history. In times of crisis, the government has taken advantage of the American people. It preys on them, and that's what's happened here. Particularly when we talk about the FBI regulations, I mean, it was not that long ago. We don't have to go back 100 years. All we have to go back is between 1950 and 1970. We know that there were real significant civil liberties infringements placed upon civil rights activists like Martin Luther King. Phones that were tapped, campaigns that were started, fishing expeditions to, like, search for things for people that went on for years and years and years. And so guidelines were put in place in the 70s so that the government could not spy randomly on the American people for their political beliefs. And now those guidelines have been lifted. None of the laws that changed would have affected the information or the events of September 11th. The FBI has an enormous amount of information. Right now, what we do know and what we've seen in the past few weeks is they don't have the ability to go through all of the information that they have. So we don't need to give them more opportunities to gather more information. We need to make sure that they are analyzing the information that they currently have.
What are some of your concerns, Tracy Younger, about where this is all headed if unchecked, where the White House has unilateral power to designate and imprison people they suspect of being terrorists?
I really have enormous concerns because it's harder to get it back once you've given it away. And I think that if the Bush administration continues at the level they are, we will have nothing left. We will have turned over everything, and there is still no assurance that there will not be another terrorist attack. There is no assurance that we are a safer, more sound society. All it means is that we are have handed over a whole bunch of rights, and not just ours, not just this generation, but the next generation, because history will repeat itself. And if we're looking back and saying, oh, 40, 50 years ago we did that, so let's do it again today, is it going to take us another 40 and 50 years to get to the point we are today? I mean, I'm very concerned about what the future looks like. What legacies are we leaving our children? And when we hand over our rights, we're also handing over the rights of the person sitting next to us. And we all need to be very aware of what those rights are. Because once they're gone, you don't know when they are going to get used against you. You know, you don't know who's going to come knocking on your door. And because the definition of terrorism is so incredibly broad in the USA Patriot Bill, we need to be very aware of what's happening around us. Because the government, if they can just pick and choose at any time which American citizens will be terrorists, they might pick and choose you one day.
That was Tereza Younger, Executive Director of the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union. For more information, contact the American Civil Liberties Union by calling area code 212-549-2500 or visit its website at www.aclu.org. The progressive community won a landmark victory in a California court last week when two Earth First activists won a multi-million dollar civil suit against the Oakland Police Department and the FBI. In the spring of 1990, Earth Firsters Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney were organizing for a massive non-violent protest against clear-cutting in the old-growth redwood forest of California. When a bomb exploded in their car, severely wounding Barry, Oakland police and the FBI arrested the pair and charged them with knowingly transporting the bomb. After a weeks-long smear campaign, charges were dropped for lack of evidence. Barry and Cherney then sued the Oakland police and federal bureau, charging them with violating their Fourth Amendment right to free speech. On June the 11th, following a six-week civil trial and 3 weeks of jury deliberations, the plaintiffs, Cherney and the estate of Judy Barry, who died of breast cancer in 1997, were awarded a $4.4 million judgment against six members of the Oakland police and FBI. In the 12 years between the bomb blast and the court victory, the activists' legal team, operating as the Redwood Summer Justice Project, aggressively pursued the case, conducting hundreds of depositions and fending off two attempts to have the charges dropped. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alicia Littletree, who worked as a paralegal on the case for 9 years. She discusses the trial in the context of current political events and the plaintiff's difficult decision to request a 6-month postponement of the trial after the September the 11th terrorist attacks.
We were very concerned that on October 1st, which is the original trial date, there was no way we could get a fair trial because everybody was pretty much hysterical, you know. Rightly so. It was a horrible thing that happened, but it's a very bad time for us to take the FBI to trial. Yeah, we asked for a six-month delay. We thought, you know, if we go now, we just can't win. And so 6 months later, of course, we go to trial, and the FBI is under fire for not having their act together around tips that could have helped them prevent September 11th. So it's much better time for us.
That really worked out to your advantage, because you had no way of knowing that.
No, but, you know, I suspected that something like that might happen because people at a certain time are going to be looking for reasons why and why there were failures in the quote-unquote intelligence before September 11th. I was really hoping that, you know, that people would cast a critical eye on the federal agencies, and that's what they've been doing, so... I guess we waited long enough.
I don't know if the jurors, if they can or have spoken out after the verdict, but what do you think won them over to your side?
Well, for the first part of your question, the jurors have been gagged by the judge. We're pretty baffled by it, but she's prevented them from talking to us or the media, so we really don't know exactly what. We can only speculate as to why. But it's a pretty easy speculation because the evidence in our case was really strong, and the FBI and the Oakland police really didn't come up with anything to counter it. In fact, to their disadvantage, the FBI and Oakland police pointed fingers at each other. At the beginning of the second week, it became clear that this case has gone from Judy Berry versus the FBI to the FBI versus the Oakland police and vice versa. They were blaming each other. They had very contradictory statements. You know, FBI blamed Oakland, Oakland blamed the FBI. And I mean, it was dramatic. They were saying, you know, well, if he said that, he lied. And then we'd ask the other person, well, you know, you heard him say that. What do you think? Well, that's just not true. You know, so it was clear that somebody was lying, probably everybody was lying, and that wasn't lost on the jury.
Well, who did you have testify for your side?
A lot of cops testified for us. Against their will, of course, they weren't our witnesses, but we were calling them for our case. And then a lot of Judy's associates and family members and friends testified because they were caught up in the activities right around the bombing. They were caught up in the police raids and the sweeps, and some of them were questioned. Some of them should have been questioned and never were. Judy's daughter testified about the effect of the false charges on her mom's life. And Daryl Cherney, of course, the other plaintiff in the case, the passenger in the car, also testified. He testified for about a day and a half.
In finding for the plaintiffs, is the decision basically, are they saying that, in fact, their rights were violated and that the FBI and the Oakland police did a lot of illegal things, or is it a narrow decision? Can you just explain that a little bit?
No, actually it's not a narrow decision because we had both Fourth Amendment and First Amendment violations. The Fourth Amendment was the false arrests and the illegal searches. And actually, in Daryl's case, the jury hung on the false arrest charge. So Judy was falsely arrested, Judy's house was illegally searched, and Daryl's house was illegally searched. But then the broad part of it is they gave us the First Amendment charges. They did it in order to target her political speech, her political activism. And that is huge. When we got to that part of the verdict being read, I turned to our lead attorney, Dennis Cunningham. I said, we won. Because that was the important charge, was not just that they had done these things, but that they had done them with the intention of suppressing Judy and Daryl's political activities. And that's exactly what we were going for.
Wow. So is it over now?
No, it's not. This part's over, thank goodness. But no, it's not over. There's going to be appeals on both sides. We have some of our own issues we'd like to bring before the appeals court, some pretrial rulings that let certain top FBI agents and supervisors out of the case. We would like that revisited because we believe that they belong. They deserve their own trial, another trial. Of course, there's that issue of the Daryl's false arrest. The jury was undecided. They couldn't reach a unanimous verdict one way or the other on that. So that means that on that charge, there's a mistrial, and that charge needs to be retried.
In terms of the progressive movement, what does victory say to people who are struggling with similar issues, and also the fact that the administration is trying to restrict people's First Amendment rights?
It really does underscore our claims that the FBI uses its broad powers to spy and gather information against activists. If they ever did a real investigation of the FBI's conduct pre-September 11th, I think that's exactly what they would find. That, yeah, they're doing a lot of stuff, but none of it really goes to fighting terrorism. It goes to fighting dissent.
That was Alicia Littletree of the Redwood Summer Justice Project. Contact the project by calling area code 707-887-0262 or visit its website at www.judybari.org. That's www.judybari.org. Over the last several decades, a concerted effort has been made by the nation's wealthiest citizens to reduce their tax burden and do away with the nation's system of progressive taxation. Following the same trickle-down philosophy as his predecessors Ronald Reagan and his father George Bush Sr., President George W. Bush fought for and won massive tax cuts for the rich in the 2001 congressional budget. Included in that 2001 tax cut bill was the temporary repeal of the federal estate tax, which taxes the inherited wealth of citizens passing more than $1 million to their heirs. This tax affects less than 2% of all American families, but over the past decade, a small group of the super-rich have contributed millions of dollars in an effort to abolish the estate tax forever. Over the last year, a coalition of progressive organizations calling themselves Americans for a Fair Estate Tax, which includes a number of wealthy individuals, has organized to oppose repeal of the federal inheritance tax. Their campaign was successful when legislation to permanently repeal the estate tax was defeated in the U.S. Senate on June the 12th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Scott Klinger, co-director of the group Responsible Wealth, who discusses how this coalition beat back attempts to repeal the estate tax and why he believes efforts to provide tax breaks to the wealthy exacerbate growing income inequality in the U.S.
The federal estate tax has been under assault for about the last 10 years or so. By some very conservative right-wing groups. Many of your listeners might be familiar with it being called the death tax, which is one of the very successful nomenclature's names that the other side has given to this. It's a very false name because only 2% of Americans who die pay it. The other 98% of us don't pay any sort of estate tax or inheritance tax. The other thing that's been said is that this is a tax that needs to be gotten rid of because it's hurting small business and family farmers. There are some problems, particularly with small business, that can be fixed. But small business and family farmers are not the people behind this large campaign to get rid of the tax. In fact, two family businesses in particular have poured millions of dollars into getting rid of this tax. The Mars family from the M&M candy company fame and the Gallo family that makes Gallo wines. Both very much family businesses, but not businesses that anyone would consider small or vulnerable. So we have been working. We started a year ago to provide a different voice of wealthy people who would have to pay the estate tax, people who think that this is a important tax to pay, that who support paying it, who have paid it for their deceased relatives and will probably pay it themselves. So last year we collected the names of 1,000 affluent Americans, some of whom are household names, most of whom are not, and many of whom own small businesses, a few own farms, and who have said this is an important tax to keep. This is important to not allowing concentration of wealth to grow unchecked in America, and it also provides very valuable money to run the government and services that we all benefit from.
How much money does the federal government take in each year from the estate tax, and how would the tax burden shift if it was permanently repealed?
The estate tax this year takes in about $30 billion, which is about 9% of the non-defense discretionary part of the budget. So this is not Medicare, not Defense Department. It's the rest of the budget, things like the post office and roads and schools and affordable housing, public health, things like that. Things that are very important and vital to many Americans and certainly hold our communities together. It's bigger than several cabinet departments' entire budgets, including the Commerce Department and the Agriculture Department. And if it goes away, what will happen is we'll either see the tax burden shifted to other groups and other tax rates will rise, or we'll see services cut.
Scott, can you explain a little bit more about the coalition that won this battle last week? Who makes up the coalition of groups opposed to the permanent repeal of the estate tax, and how did you win this fight?
It's a variety of groups. It's made up largely of various nonprofits, some that are providing government services, others that are interested in charitable giving, preserving the incentive for wealthy people to give to nonprofits and universities and museums. And it's some labor unions, and especially public service labor unions, who know that their employees would be losing their jobs if the estate tax is cut. We won because we worked very hard to turn out grassroots support. My organization alone made thousands of calls. When people act together, sometimes democracy can work and things do actually change.
Scott, could you explain the drive for tax cuts by conservative politicians and their wealthy allies in this country in the context of growing income and wealth inequality in the United States?
Well, we have seen over the last decade a widening in inequality. There was some recent census data that was released that suggested that the median income for across the country rose about $3,000 between 1990 and 2000. But what also happened in many states was that there was what's called a barbell economy, growth in both ends at the very rich and at the very poor end of the economy. That's on the income side. If we look at the wealth side, from the mid-1970s, the top 1% of the U.S. population owned 22% of the privately controlled wealth. So 1% owned nearly a quarter of the pie. By 1998, the end of the 90s, the top 1% owned 38% of the privately owned wealth in the country, and the bottom 99% owned 62%. So they almost doubled their share of the national wealth. And a lot of that has to do with tax changes in tax policy. So tax policy has played a big role in increasing inequality in this country, and that's another reason for keeping the estate tax. It's something it doesn't do enough, but at least it is something that begins to capture some of that wealth that has been accumulated during a person's lifetime.
That was Scott Klinger, co-director of Responsible Wealth, a project of United for a Fair Economy. Contact the group by calling 877-564-6833 or visit its website at www.responsiblewealth.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.